Zia Jezierska. It's called The Open Cage. I live in a massive, outmoded apartment house converted for roomers. A once fashionable residence now swarming with six times as many people as it was built for. 300 of us cook our solitary meals on two-burner gas stoves in our dingy, furnished rooms. We slide past each other in the narrow hallways on our way to the community bathrooms or up and down the stairs without speaking. But in our rooms, with doors closed, we are never really alone. We are invaded by the sounds of living around us, water gurgling in the sinks of neighboring rooms, the harsh slamming of a door, a shrill voice on the hall telephone, the radio from upstairs colliding with the television set next door. Worse than the racket of the radios are the smells of cooking mixing with the odors of dusty carpets and the unventilated accumulation left by the roomers who preceded us. These stale layers of smells seep under the closed door. I keep the window open in the coldest weather to escape the smells. Sometimes, after a long wait for the bathroom, you get inside only to find that the last person left the bathtub dirty. And sometimes the man whose room is right next to the bath and who works nights gets so angry with the people who wake him up taking their morning baths that he hides the bathtub stopper. One morning, I hurried to take my bath while the tub was still clean, only to find that the stopper was missing. I rushed angrily back to my room and discovered I had locked myself out. The duplicate key was downstairs in the office, and I was still in my bathrobe with a towel around my neck. I closed my eyes like an ostrich, not to be seen by anyone, and started down the stairway. While getting the key, I found a letter in my mailbox. As soon as I was inside my room, I reached for my glasses on the desk. They weren't there. I searched the desk drawers, the bureau drawers, the shelf by the sink. Finally, in despair, I searched the pockets of my clothes. All at once, I realized that I had lost my letter, too. In that moment of fury, I felt like kicking and screaming at my failing memory, the outrage of being old. Old and feeble-minded, in a house where the man down the hall revenges himself on his neighbors, where rumor hates rumor because each one hates himself for being trapped in this house that's not a home, but a prison where the soul dies long before the body is dead. My glance, striking the mirror, fixed in a frightened stare at the absurd old face looking at me. I tore off the eye shade and saw the narrowing slits where eyes had been. Damn the man who hid the bathtub stopper. Damn them all. There was a tap at the door, and I ignored it. The tapping went on. I kicked open the door at the intruder, but no one was there. I took my ready-made printed sign, "Busy, please do not disturb," and hung it on the door. The tapping began again. No, no, no one at the door. It was something stirring in the farthest corner of the molding. I moved toward it. A tiny bird, wings hunched together, fluttered helplessly. I jumped back at the terrible fear of something alive and wild in my room. "My God," I told myself, "it's only a little bird. Why am I so scared?" With a whirring of wings, the bird landed on the window frame. I wanted to push it out to freedom, but I was too afraid to touch it. For a moment, I couldn't move, but I couldn't bear to be in the same room with that frightened little bird. I rushed out to Sadie Williams. A few times, when her door was open, I had seen parakeets flying freely about the room. I had often overheard her love talk to her birds, who responded to her like happy children to their mother. "Mama loves baby. Baby loves mama. Come, honey bunch. Come, darling Tweedledee, Tweedledum. Bonnie boy, dearest, come for your bath. Her room was only a few doors away, and yet she had never invited me in. But now I banged on her door, begging for help. Who is it? She shouted. For God's sake, I cried, a bird flew into my room. It's stuck by the window. It can't fly out. In an instant, she had brushed past me into my room. Where's the bird? She demanded. My God, I cried, where is it? Where is it? It must have flown out. Sadie moved to the open window. Poor darling, she said, it must have fallen out. Why didn't you call me sooner? Before I could tell her anything, she was gone. I sat down, hurt by her unfriendliness. The vanished bird left a strange silence in my room. Why was I so terrified of the helpless little thing? I might have given it a drink of water, a few crumbs of bread. I might have known what to do if only I had not lost my glasses, if that brute of a man hadn't hid the bathtub stopper. A sudden whirring of wings crashed into my thoughts. The bird peered at me from the molding. I fled to Sadie Williams. Come quick, I begged. The bird, the bird. Sadie burst into my room ahead of me. There it was, peering at us from the farthest corner of the molding. Chickadee, chickadee, dee, 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 Sadie crooned, cupping her hands toward the bird. Come, fee, fee, darling, come, honey. On tiptoes, she inched closer, 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 cooing in that same bird voice, until at last, in one quick, deft movement, she cupped the frightened bird in her hands. Fee, fee, darling. Sadie caressed it with a finger, holding it to her large breast. I'll put you into the guest cage. It's just been cleaned for you. Without consulting me, she carried the bird to her room. A little cage with fresh water was ready. Shooing away her parakeets, she gently placed the bird on the swing and closed the cage. Take a little water, fee, fee, dear, she coaxed. I'll get some seed you'll like. With a nimble leap, the bird alighted on the floor of the cage and dipped its tiny beak into the water. It drinks! It drinks! I cried joyfully. Oh, Sadie, you've saved my baby bird. Shh, she admonished, but I went on gratefully. You're wonderful! Wonderful! Shut up! You're scaring the bird! Forgive me, I implored in a lower voice. So much has happened to me this morning, and the bird scared me. Poor thing. But I'm not dressed. May I leave my baby with you for a while longer? You know so well how to handle it. Back in my room, I dressed hurriedly. Why did I never dream that anything so wonderful as this bird would come to me? Is it because I never had a pet as a child that this bird meant so much to me in the loneliness of old age? This morning, I did not know of its existence. And now it had become my only kin on earth. I shared its frightened helplessness away from its kind. Suddenly, I felt jealous of Sadie caring for my bird, lest it get fonder of her than of me. But I was afraid to annoy her by coming back too soon. So I set to work to give my room a thorough cleaning to ensure a happy home for my bird. I swept the floor. And before I could gather up the sweeping and the dustpan, another shower of loose plaster came raining down. How could I clean up the dinginess, the dirt, in the stained walls? An overwhelming need to be near my bird made me drop my cleaning and go to Sadie. I knocked at the door. There was no answer, so I barged in. Sadie was holding the tiny thing in her cupped hands, breathing into it, moaning anxiously. Fee, fee, darling. Stunned with apprehension, I watched her slowly surrendering the bird into the cage. What's the matter? I clutched her arm. It won't eat. It only took a sip of water. It's starving, but is too frightened to eat. We'll have to let it go. It's my bird, I pleaded. It came to me. I won't let it go. It's dying. Do you want it to die? Why is it dying? I cried, bewildered. It's a wild bird. It has to be free. I was too stunned to argue. Go get your hat and coat. We're going to Riverside Drive. My bird, in her cage, I had no choice but to follow her out into the park. In a grove full of trees, Sadie stopped and rested the cage on a thick bush. As she moved her hand, I grabbed the cage and had it in my arms before either of us knew what I had done. It's so small, I pleaded, tightening my arms around the cage. It'll only get lost again. Who'll take care of it? Don't be a child, she said, coldly. Birds are smarter than you. Then in afterthought, she added, You know what you need? You need to buy yourself a parakeet. Afterwards, I'll go with you to the pet store and help you pick a bird that'll talk to you and love you. A bought bird? I was shocked. A bird bought to love me? She knew so much about birds and so little about my feelings. My bird came to me from the sky, I told her. It came to my window and of all the windows of the neighborhood. Sadie lifted the cage out of my arms and put it back on the bush. Now, watch and see, she said. She opened the cage door and very gently took the bird out, holding it in her hand and looking down at it. You mustn't let it go, I said. You mustn't. She didn't pay any attention to me, just opened her fingers slowly. I wanted to stop her, but instead I watched. For a moment, the little bird stayed where it was. Then Sadie said something softly, lovingly, and lifted her hand with the bird on it. There was a flutter, a spread of wings, and then the sudden strong freedom of a bird returning to its sky. I cried out, Look, it's flying! My frightened baby bird, soaring so sure of itself, lifted me out of my body. I felt myself flying with it, and I stood there staring, watching it go higher and higher. I lifted my arms, flying with it. I saw it now, not only with sharpened eyesight, but with sharpened senses of love. Even as it vanished into the sky, I rejoiced in its power to go beyond me. I said aloud, exulting, It's free! I looked at Sadie. Whatever I had thought of her, she was the one who had known what the little bird needed. All the other times I had seen her, she had remembered only herself, but with the bird she forgot. Now, with the empty cage in her hand, she turned to go back to the apartment house we had left. I followed her. We were leaving the bird behind us, and we were going back into our own cage. That was called The Open Cage by Anzia Jezierska. Many people are concerned about the population, the human population of the Earth. What is its carrying capacity? But to answer the question, how many people can the Earth support, you have to answer a number of other more specific questions. How many people at what average level of material well-being? How many with what distribution of material well-being? How many with what technology? How many with what domestic and international political institutions? How many with what domestic and international economic arrangements? How many with what domestic and international demographic arrangements? How many in what physical, chemical, and biological environments? How many with what variability or stability? How many with what risk or robustness? How many for how long? How many with what values, tastes, and fashions? Here's another piece about old age. This is from 1998, from Los Angeles. Priscilla Yablan, the activities director at Sunset Hall, a residence for the elderly here, knows better than to list bingo on the social calendar. They're insulted if you even mention it, Yablan said. It's a ridiculous game, said one resident, Vivian Eisenberg, age 79. No, the aging lefties here, former communists, still staunch socialists, liberals, intellectuals, and other free thinkers, would rather sit around and talk than engage in bingo or any other conventional rest-home pastime. Sunset Hall, started 75 years ago by Unitarians as a home for religious liberals, is a two-story stucco building with 36 apartments in a neighborhood of Central American immigrants. Inside, it feels more like a Greenwich Village salon of 50 years ago than a Los Angeles old-age home today. The carpeting in the living room is worn, the chairs comfortable and mismatched. Coco and Taffy, a pair of dogs belonging to one of the residents, 72-year-old Olive Dunn, were napping on the sofa the other day. Pets are encouraged. The library has an extensive collection of books on Marxism, Trotsky, Mao Zedong, and the trial of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, as well as the complete works of Shakespeare. There is a framed certificate from the American Civil Liberties Union honoring Sunset Hall's tradition of activism on one wall, a picture of Paul Robeson on another, and, on a shelf, a bust of Lenin. At 101, Jacob Darnov, a rabbi's son from Russia, who was a messenger in the Bolshevik army, is unwavering in his admiration for Lenin. He's the greatest politician we ever had in this world, said Darnov, whose other hero is Leo Tolstoy. Darnov was sitting around and talking the other afternoon with several other residents. As usual, the state of the country was on the table, and, as usual, the discussion was freeform, ranging from the need to organize to prevent any cutbacks in Social Security to the issue of women in politics. I've been hoping to see a woman as president, preferably a black woman, said Gladys Forman, 90, who has a National Health Insurance bumper sticker on her apartment door, and proudly recalls how, at age 8, she was proclaimed a little socialist by her father. As for the wife of the current president, Rosemary Onan, age 72, a retired schoolteacher, said, I don't think Hillary is active enough. You can never be active enough, said Sylvia Carlson, 85, who is the author of a book on cinematography. To the 26 residents of Sunset Hall, being active has nothing to do with exercise. Their idea of a good field trip is one in which they can be useful. They once decorated the Sunset Hall van with crepe paper and balloons, piled into it with their wheelchairs and walkers, and rode through downtown Los Angeles in a show of support for the janitors' strike. They went to a city council meeting on the same matter. But the meeting was long, and the Sunset Hall contingent got tired and left early. They are mostly in their 80s and 90s now, and frail, with their marching days behind them. But their sympathies remain with workers everywhere. They're always telling the staff here, don't work so hard. Take a break, said Yablan, who is 70 and has done plenty of marching herself for leftist causes. Lately, there has been talk of taking up a petition for a Sunset Hall employee who was let go. The system owes every man a job, said Darnov, who emigrated to America in 1922 and worked as a potato farmer, a house painter, and in an auto plant. The residents try to stay informed. They subscribe to the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times. If the television is on, it is usually tuned to CNN. They clamor for guest speakers. The more cutting edge, the better. They wanted to talk to lesbians, LeBond said. So she brought in a couple. The number of residents at Sunset Hall has been dwindling with the years, in part because of fears of the neighborhood, which has had trouble with gangs. In addition, older people are remaining in their own homes for a longer period of time. One of Sunset Hall's supporters is the folk singer Pete Seeger. When Sunset Hall needed money to stay open 9 years ago, Seeger gave a fundraising concert. After much debate, the board of directors recently raised the rates, which range from $700 a month to $2,000 a month, including meals, housekeeping services, and varying degrees of personal care. Most of the residents are on fixed incomes. There was a long political fight about it, said Wayne Friedlander, who ran Sunset Hall until the end of March, when he resigned to pursue other interests. It went against the spirit of Sunset Hall. It has a long history of undercharging. In an effort to recruit new residents, Dunn, the resident computer whiz, has set up a website for Sunset Hall. Some of the old standards have been relaxed. We even had a Republican in here for a while, Yablon said. She was a pleasant person. She wouldn't discuss politics. She moved out because the cooking was not to her liking. She wanted white bread. Sunset Hall has egg bread, rye bread, and whole wheat bread, but no white bread. The residents make decisions about the food through a meal planning committee. Friedlander began a weekly wine and cheese party, which was wildly popular from the start. But lately, a battle has been raging over that, too. A local physician heard about the party and protested loudly to the Sunset Hall Board of Directors that elderly men and women should not be drinking alcohol. Friedlander has been fighting, so far successfully, to keep the wine in the wine and cheese party. In the living room, the other afternoon, the residents were standing firm against the idea of an alcohol-free wine and cheese party. That would take the life out of it, Eisenberg said. We don't drink that much, for God's sake. The conversation then turned to socialism. Foreman, the author of an unpublished book called How Adam and Eve Lost Their Social Security, made a prediction. Socialism, crushed to the earth, will rise again. Rose Hoffman, 85, a former journalist for a trade union newspaper, wanted specifics. Name a date, she said. Saturday, Foreman said. Here's a curious development in human behavior from Columbia University in New York. Sandra Lederman decided at age 46 that she wanted children. Her doctor told her she couldn't conceive and urged her to find an egg donor. Lederman of Houston placed an ad in the student newspaper at Columbia University. She offered to pay a donor $25,000. We targeted Columbia because my husband and I are selective, and we know that the university is selective, she said. Lederman is one of a growing number of Americans seeking elite human eggs. In response, many college-age women are selling their eggs to pay their tuition. Buying and selling eggs is legal because human eggs are classified by federal law as tissue rather than organs, according to Gregory Kabnick. He is editor of the Hastings Center Report, a journal published by the Hastings Center for Bioethics. Kabnick said no state has restricted payments for eggs, but some states limit the number of times a woman may donate. A recent ad in the Harvard Crimson read, $50,000 for Jewish egg donor. Another offered $25,000 for an egg donor with at least a 1500 SAT score. An ad like that compelled Jennifer to undergo the procedure. She spoke on condition that her last name not be used because she has exceeded the legal donation limit in her state. She has made $70,000 for 8 procedures and paid for her Ivy League law degree. Many of the women who answer ads aren't aware of the extensive procedure and potential dangers associated with donating eggs, said Karen Sinestu, co-owner and director of the Center for Surrogate Parenting and Egg Donation in Beverly Hills, California. This is a highly regimented process involving weekly doctor appointments in the beginning and daily visits towards the end. There is a lot involved here, she said. Once a donor has been selected and undergone mental and physical testing, she begins drug therapy to synchronize the donor's and recipient's menstrual cycles. Once both women's cycles are coordinated, the donor begins a second round of therapy, taking daily self-injections to stimulate her ovaries so that she produces 12 eggs. When her ovaries are ripe, the donor's eggs are harvested. The doctor usually administers a local anesthetic and then extracts the eggs through the uterus. It really hurts to go through all of this, and it's exhausting to have all of those drugs in my system, Jennifer said. You go through symptoms of menopause, fatigue, and hot flashes. It's hard, but I'm not planning on having any children of my own, and I know that I'm helping people. And I need the money. Rebecca Dresser, professor of law and ethics in medicine at Washington University, said, there is concern as the price for eggs increases. Eggs shouldn't be the commodity here. A woman's effort should be treated as the commodity. Here's a short piece by Anonymous. Changing the World. Like much of my generation, I grew up believing that I should try to change the world, presumably for the better. But I didn't know how to do this. Looking at how other people have changed the world, I concluded there are 5 ways of doing it. Some people change the world by imposing their will on it. Some people change the world by discovering a truth. Some people change the world by changing people's minds. Some people change the world by creating things of great beauty. And some people change the world by making new tools for change.